Ladies and gentlemen, one of my heroes, John Records Landecker, joining us here, Bob Seger, our Boulevard podcast. Hi, John, how are you?
I'm very good and glad to be on the Boulevard.
You got your shirt? You got your State of Seger shirt? We saw the pictures of that.
You know, I have to tell folks that, you know, the radio industry has trade magazines, trade publications that are online, and I don't know, a month ago, whatever it was, I'm trolling the internet as usual, and I see this fantastic T-shirt. And I go, I got to have one of those. And lo and behold, I eventually did get one. And I think it's awesome. I love the Boulevard bumper sticker, too. I think it's awesome. Great stuff.
Thank you so much, John. It was kind of surprising to us that no one had dedicated a street to Bob Seger in Detroit.
Yeah. Considering everything that Seger has done over the years, that is a bit of a surprise.
Yeah. And then the idea, the shirt idea came up. We were just talking about it. So the Seger shirt had all the song titles in the back. But, yeah, it's fun to see here because we've got our six shows coming up at Pine Knob, you know, with Bob. But I'm always interested. Yeah, it's interesting to me, John, that so for you, you sent me some amazing audio with Bob that I've never heard before. When did you do this interview with Bob?
Well, I believe it's around 1977. And it was recorded after a concert in Chicago at what was then the Chicago Stadium. I'm from Ann Arbor. Bob Seger's from Ann Arbor. Well, moved to Ann Arbor, I guess, when he was five, but grew up there. Went to Ann Arbor Pioneer High School. And let's see, he's 2 years older than I am, but we sort of came up through the same, obviously, geographical area, but also, you know, musically at that time, Detroit, Ann Arbor, that area was really active with all sorts of bands starting like in the early 60s and also including Motown and Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels and the MC5 and Iggy Pop and the Stooges and, you know, Detroit still is, and always has been a pretty hard rockin' town. And I just gravitated to everything that Seger did. I jumped on a little late, I think. Heavy Music was the first big Seger song that I was aware of. But since then, I've got all of them, including the stuff that was done on the Cameo Parkway label, which eventually went out of business, I guess.
Right. Yeah. It's at least now we're getting more stuff remastered. You know, we're able to get our hands to some stuff that for a long time, even folks here in the Motor City, John, we couldn't get.
Well, the thing that was really frustrating, I guess that might be the word, certainly it was frustrating for Seger, was I was working in Chicago and knew all about Bob Seger. And I knew that he would, you know, sell out huge concerts in the Detroit area and then come to Chicago and play some suburban rock club for like 300 or 400 people. But thankfully that eventually all changed. And I think the first turnaround was probably Ramblin' Gamblin' Man. And then you get the Silver Bullet Band and everything after that. Night Moves, Hollywood Nights, We've Got Tonight, all of those great hits.
Well, you think too, John, that period of live albums. I mean, obviously Live Bullet. I mean, and people think that, well, Bob just went and recorded this. This was the same set they were doing for what, 4 years on the road?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look like a commie and you might just be a member, get out of Denver. That is one of my favorite Seger tunes. And, you know, that album he's just a rock and roll guy. What can I tell you? No ifs, ands, or buts. And I love it that he's from the Midwest. And obviously, you know, being from Ann Arbor, that gives me a little extra pride about knowing somebody that came up in that area who succeeded so dramatically in the rock business. It was pretty cool. When I was in high school in Ann Arbor, I thought I'd be a little DJ and got a job at it was called the Ann Arbor Armory. And what I would do would in between sets that bands were who would appear there, I'd get a bunch of 45 RPM records and sit on the stage with a sound system and play them. And, but all sorts of interesting folks came through there. There was a band called the Prime Movers, which was a blues-based band, sort of taking a cue, I guess, from the Paul Butterfield Blues Band.
Right.
And the drummer was Jim Osterberg. Who,
really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, who was eventually Iggy Pop. So it was pretty cool. And there was a local band out of Ann Arbor called The Rationals, and they did a song on... On A Square Records called Respect, and, Detroit Radio was just fantastic with, there was AM stations that were hits at that time, WKNR, WXYZ, CKLW, then there was, the transition over to FM that occurred, and it was just a really cool town.
What's the
limited?
Yeah, what's the story, John? That like Bob wrote Rosalie to get Rosalie Trombley to play on CKLW, and the irony was she never played that song on CKLW. She refused to. She refused to because it embarrassed her. And then I remember Thin Lizzy when they covered it too. That's one of the best covers of a Bob Seger song I've ever heard. I don't know how many people even know that exists. It's a great version.
And he and Springsteen linked up too, and did shared the stage in Detroit a few times. And that kind of rock and roll is my meat and potatoes, if you will. And obviously, the longevity of those songs speaks for itself.
Hey, I want to play, John, I want to play this one clip. You mentioned that. This is right around 77 when he's talking about being changed by success. Let me fire this one off real quick.
Not much, really, because I had a long time to prepare for it, The best example I can give you is like when Ramla Gamma Man came out, Myself, my manager, and the band that I had at that time were completely unprepared for success. We're just sort of blown away by it, by all the things that went along with it, the heavy touring and all that stuff. And this time, when we finally started to get some action, on Beautiful Loser and stuff, I think the guys in this band, they'd all been through it, sort of. They're all in their own bands, their own local bands, they'd all gone through the frustrations and everything, and they realized that it was going to take some time, but that the only way to do it was to really buckle down and commit. All certain things like, playing basically the same show every night until you'd covered the whole country, Little things like that we didn't do in the old days. We'd play whatever we felt like playing, and there was no consistency to our performances, and there was no consistency, to our records, because they were real hit and miss. They were made on real low budgets and everything, and made real fast, and... just a lot of, unprofessional doing,
I love that clip, John. I love that clip because it gives you a little insight into Bob's mindset that really, it turned the corner for them.
Well, I had never met Bob prior to that concert. And of course I knew the whole history of Ann Arbor. So I really wanted to impress upon him that I was a Detroit area Ann Arbor guy. So I brought a pack of a six pack of Verners.
Did you really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
to backstage at the Chicago Stadium. Look, Bob, I'm really from the Midwest. Look, I'm really from Ann Arbor, Detroit. I got a six pack of Verners here. I haven't saved. I've talked to a few rock stars over the years, and there was just something about that interview that I kept. And I got to admit it, even the audio quality of a cassette recorder in 1977 in the basement of the Chicago Stadium still holds up pretty well.
Yeah, it does.
With all the, is this the last tour sweeping across Michigan, going to Grand Rapids? I just went back and listen to it, and I'm like, wow, his answers are really good.
Yeah.
To a lot of questions about songs that are being played just as much today as they ever were. And I'm glad I kept them because, you know, and I also think, you know, in 1970, I thought about it a little bit. He's very open about everything. And obviously it's decades ago. And, you know, the big success that Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band had started not long before that. And so I don't think that he was as, I don't know, not the word jaded, but that's certainly not the word I mean. But, you know, over the years, I'm sure the answers might have become a little different, or they changed with time or more reflection. But there's just something raw about and fresh about what I hear in his voice in that interview that really impressed me. And, you know, the some of the songs that, you know, you and I just like, for instance, Hollywood Nights, I asked him about it, and he goes, well, you know, we needed a rocker.
Right.
So I just sat down and wrote it. What do you mean we need a rocker? You know, so I'll just, like, whip this off. And he had lived, I guess he had lived out in Hollywood for a while. I forget what it was for, recording something or writing something. And, you know, he's a Midwestern dude through and through. And that experience in the West Coast did not change him, you know.
Well, remember, John, his student was Glenn Frey. I mean, he was Glenn's mentor. So,
yeah.
You know, Bob would spend a lot of time out there with Glenn and behind the scenes, even with the Eagles. I've always heard the story that the long run would have never been finished if Bob hadn't gone out there and kind of kicked him in the ass to, and a lot of the lyrics, he gets sort of uncredited credit for making sure they got it done.
Totally. And I was, you know, I'm in the business. I'm in radio since, I don't know, 65, and I'm in Chicago from throughout the 70s. I wasn't even aware of that. And when he did Heartache Tonight on the Kennedy Honors, I think it was.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Man, that just blew me away. I thought that was fantastic. And here I am, totally in the dark, that he had contributed, not only that he had contributed to the Eagles, but the Eagles, he and the Glenn Frey, had contributed to the things that he had done. And that's just very cool.
Well, if you, and
great music.
Yeah, if you, Ramblin' Gammon, that's Glenn doing backup vocals on there.
Yeah.
Fire Lake,
yeah.
It's the whole Eagles. I've always been told, John, and I don't know if this is true, but I got enough friends here that have said that there are tapes of the Eagles doing the lead vocals for Fire Lake.
That I would love to hear.
Oh, I know, right?
But
I mean, hold on. I want to play you mentioned the Hollywood Nights clip. I've got it right here. This is Bob again, 1977, right?
I think so, yeah.
Talking about Hollywood Nights.
Hollywood Nights was like, it was like the last song written for the album, and I'd been in Hollywood for 3 months. I had to rent a house out there because we did the album out there. And I'd just been living there, and we had all the other 8 songs done. And we had mixed everything. And I looked at everything, and I said, well, I think we need another rocker. It's just, you know, as dumb as this sounds, it's exactly what happened when I wrote the song. I just said, I need to write another big rocker and a big strong rocker. And I sat down and I wrote it in 45 minutes. Hollywood Nights was just sort of like a tongue-in-cheek thing, you know, about the Midwestern, shall we say, myth. You know, the myth that people in the Midwest have about Hollywood. A lot of Midwestern guilt, you know, feelings. You know, you know that Midwestern ethic of, you know, well, if, you know, those rich people. You can't trust a rich person because he must be doing something illegal.
I love that, dude. That's awesome.
That is just one of my... You can't trust a rich person because they must be doing something illegal.
I love that.
He's great.
That was Stranger in Town. That was 78. So, right around 77 when he was pulling this all together and probably talking about what was coming up. So,
yeah.
And Hollywood Nights, I've always heard the story. Don Brewer, when he would drum for Bob, said he hated playing that song on drums because it would just kill him.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear artists and musicians say after they've had a huge hit with something, you know, I didn't really like that record when I recorded it, or I didn't want to release that on the album, or the record company didn't want to put that out, or I didn't like playing that song, or comments like that, and then these songs just turn out to be iconic rock classics that stand the test of time, literally over the decades. I mean, it's just obviously an interesting process as to how musicians conceive, record, release, and hopefully have success with tunes, almost by mistake in some instances.
I've always thought about this. There's one thing that a parallel between you and Bob, John. John Records Landecker joining us here on the Bob Seger Boulevard podcast. John, did you understand the scope of your influence? I mean, when you were WS, when you were reaching, what, how many, 38 states, something like that? I mean, it was crazy what you guys were doing. And I always felt like you said that Midwestern sensibility. Bob never really either embraced or just didn't really deal with the fact that his music, especially after Live Bullet, reached an entire country. Everybody was listening to Live Bullet.
Well, I appreciate the comparison between Bob Seger and my career, but in that regard, I think you're absolutely right. And I've talked about it before with some people, and for people in Detroit who don't know, this radio station in Chicago was really big, and it was big in the ratings, and it was one of those big AM radio stations back in the 70s and the 60s that, you know, you'd be out on the highway with the car radio tuning around, and it would come in it would come into Michigan from Chicago at night easily, and
yeah.
And in a lot of other places. But it's, you know, the whole ego trip of it's all about me or whatever, that didn't apply. I never thought about the extent, if you want to call it, of the reach of that, or the effect it was having. You know, I was there to have a good time. That's why I went into radio, because it wasn't work. And that's
you're not wrong. You're not wrong. Every time somebody bitches about radio, I go, hey, man, there's a shovel in my garage. You want to go dig a goddamn ditch? And they're like, shut up. We're in radio. What are you complaining about? The only time I sweat is if there's no creamer for the coffee. Shut up. I mean, good Lord.
Right. So, and I was surrounded by a bunch of other people at that radio station that had exactly the same mindset. We came in to do a job that we had a good time doing, and that was about the beginning, middle, and end of it. And fortunately for us, all of us who were at the radio station, we garnered a large audience on the way. But no, I had no idea the scope. You know, people would say these numbers, like you're in these many states at night, you have X amount of million listeners or whatever it is, and who can think of those terms? You know, I mean, you're in a radio studio, you're talking into a microphone, you're having fun, and hopefully some people come along and listen to it. But other than that, it's sort of a love of what you do. I mean, I didn't get into radio to be a star, B for the money or anything else. You know, I was fortunate enough to be successful, you know, I never had a better time in radio, just as a good time. Never had a better time than the very first job I ever had in high school when I was in Ann Arbor. I mean, yeah, I had, you know, bigger jobs, obviously more money, really good time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But just for the pure joy of it, you know, that was is always going to be a great memory for me, because it was just a fascination that I had from the very beginning about radio.
Well, and that's that to me, John. I'm sorry. That to me is like the why I relate in a lot of ways your career track and everything with Bob. That, you know, when Live Bullet broke, he'd been doing this for well over 10 years. I mean, it wasn't anything new to him. And I flew down a couple months ago and watched one of his shows in Dallas. And to see him in another market outside of Detroit is always interesting how people react to him. And the fans, everybody sang along to We've Got Tonight and all the songs, you know. But Bob still takes a moment in every concert and looks out in the crowd and takes it all in. And you just get this feeling that there's this guy in front of you who's sold God knows how many millions of albums, and he is blown away that people have come to hear his music. He still acts like that guy.
You know what? Okay, I'll take the comparison, because to this day, if somebody says they listen to me, I'm always amazed. Like,
come on.
Really?
Really?
No, honest to God. Seriously. You did? Well, thank you. You know, you just don't take it for granted. I don't know this for sure, but he doesn't take his success for granted.
No, not at all.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the comment you made about seeing him in other cities, I saw him in the Chicago area at a place called Poplar Creek, which I don't think exists anymore. It was an outdoor venue in the summer. And, man, it was just unbelievable. Obviously, that concert in 77 that I went to and recorded the interview was great. I remember being really cold. It was the middle of winter. It was snow. I had a girlfriend in New York who couldn't make it back to Detroit to see to Chicago to see the concert. And then about 10 years later, I guess it was, or maybe less, this show at Poplar Creek was just magic. And it was Alto Reed, the saxophone player, was like on a wireless mic and was up on top of this wall. And it was just, when he went into a solo, and it was just mind-blowing. Just a great band, you know, just a great rock star, just a really down-to-earth Midwestern guy who wonders where rich people got their money. You know, he's not going to change. He's still the same, to quote a Bob
Oh,
Seger.
Well played. Look at you. You should be on the radio. Well played with that one, Sean. I was told, you mentioned that, I was told by Moose Brown, and he said this in an interview, so I'm not going to get in trouble, when he sings When Autumn's Closing In, when he stops and does that song, when he plays it on stage now, Moose swears that he stops for a second and looks out at the crowd, and if you notice the band, they all turn and look at him because Autumn is closing in as we kind of wrap up Bob's performance career. It's a very interesting moment, one of those things that, like, for a split second, everybody's on the same page, or turning the same page. See, another Seger reference there.
Uh-huh.
Same?
Okay. Yeah. No, I get that, and I think you're right. I think that probably does happen.
So, you know, too, you mentioned the Bob Seger Boulevard sticker. Glenn Frey Drive was something I'd done here with the radio station years ago when we found out after Glenn passed away so suddenly. Well, at least suddenly that, you know, we knew as fans. Bob put that picture on the back of his last album, I Knew You When. That's when you see Glenn Frey Drive on the back. That's here in Royal Oak, Michigan.
Did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah, because Glenn went to Dondero High School. I'll share a great story with you. I love the story. So Bob and Glenn knew each other, obviously, you know, the music scene in Ann Arbor and all that. And Bob's the one who kicked Glenn in the ass, said, you got to quit being in a cover band or you're never going to do anything. You got to write your own stuff. And Glenn even said, well, what if it sucks? He goes, it's going to suck, but you got to keep writing. So Bob wanted Glenn to come out with him on the road when it was the System. And I think he wanted him to play bass. Bob goes to Glenn's parents' house in Royal Oak, Michigan, and he goes to meet him, and he's talking to him, and the mom sees Bob with his long hair and says, no way you're going with that hippie. And Glenn Frey was taken out of the band because when he was like a high school kid, because he couldn't go tour with that stoner Bob Seger. And the rest is history. Isn't that crazy?
Right.
I love that story. Thanks, Mom.
That's a great story. I didn't know that.
It
didn't surprise me. You know, it was very cool. I mean, you know, just kids running around trying to break into rock and roll. That's an awesome thing to be doing.
Well, and like, you know, how many people reached out to you over your career, musicians that maybe you knew earlier on, and then all of a sudden they would pop? You know what I mean? For Bob, for example, Ken Calvert, Casey's one of my best friends here in the Motor City. You know, the casual one. Well, you think about, Ken would go and Punch would hand him stuff and go, listen to this. And he'd give him a 45 and early pressings and stuff.
Right.
So was it the same way for you kind of in Chicago that you understood what Bob meant before people in the country understood what Bob meant?
Oh, absolutely. Without question. I mentioned earlier that he'd performed before 10, 15,000 in Detroit and then come to Chicago and be at some suburban rock club. The regional aspect of that success was something that puzzled me for a while. But, you know, that happens. And if bands are fortunate enough to get airplay at that time around the country, they break out of that regional success and become a national phenomenon. I mean, there are Styx, REO Speedwagon, Cheap Trick, bands that came out of the Chicago area, Rockford, Illinois. They waited for some break for some big radio station to play their tunes. It was a different time for music and how people accessed music at that time. You know, there weren't powerful FM radio stations then that had a lot of influence. There was no, what did Arthur Penhallow always say? Yeah, baby. You know, there was none of that. There was AM. You had maybe one or two, probably two AM signals in most big cities. In Chicago, it was WLS and WCFL. And in Detroit, as I mentioned earlier, it was...
Yeah, CKLW and the big AMs that were, you know, monster stations, yeah.
And even small AMs. WXYZ, WKNR did not have huge signals as far as coverage was concerned. And they would wait and wait and wait to play a song on the air. It had to be successful in smaller cities before they dare play it add it to their playlist. And it's very frustrating for people like Bob Seger and Dennis DeYoung and Styx and Cheap Trick, because they knew they had the product. It would get some sort of small Midwestern or middle market airplay, but it never broke through to the big stations because they were so conservative as to taking a chance. And that's all you could access as a listener. You know, you didn't have the internet, you didn't have all the things that we have today that you can plug into to hear whatever it is that you want to hear. So they had a sort of a control over what was available.
Well,
and it was a big deal when, you know, Seger finally went national. It was a big deal when Styx went national. And it's a testimony to their talent and also the work ethic that they had, that they stuck with it.
See, that's what I love about, like, you know, here in Detroit, John, when you can play 2+2. To this day, we did 24 yeah. hours of Seger when we were trying to get to the Detroit dates announced. So we went on the air and did the old, hey, man, we did 24 hours of Seger, and we played everything. It was so much fun. But you can play 2+2 in East Side Story, if I were a carpenter, you can play stuff off Smokin' OPs, and people in Detroit get it. And to your point, like, I remember Kevin Cronin a couple of years ago saying that Golden Country was not a hit everywhere in the country. But in Detroit, if you don't play Sing Golden Country here, they're going to throw you off the stage. You had to play it. It was just required.
How about Sock It To Me Santa?
Absolutely. We play that during the holidays, Sock It To Me Santa with a baseball bat. That is a violent song.
Who wouldn't play that? I play it, well, wherever I am, you know, which changes these days. But, yeah, that's a staple. Man, it's not the holidays without Sock It To Me Santa.
Dominic the Donkey and Sock It To Me Santa. There you go, man. We got them all our bases covered here. I want to get back to another clip that we have. This is Bob talking about We've Got Tonight. Now, I believe Bob said in his last tour, he said it a couple times, this was his mom's favorite song.
Did not know that.
Because it was his first, like, really big hit, but she loved this song. Well, let's play your clip. It's John Records Landecker joining us here on Bob Seger Boulevard Podcast. Here's Bob talking about We've Got Tonight.
I got the idea for this song from the movie The Sting. And remember the scene where Redford goes to the girl's apartment and says, it's 2 a.m. in the morning and I'm just like you, I don't know anybody, right? Well, that was where, you know, I was watching that movie and I got the idea of how to write a song about, you know, one night stands, about two lonely people meeting and they really have nothing in common other than they need each other at that point in time, at that very moment, instant in the universe. They are together and they both need each other, and the one guy is trying to convince the lady, you know, that this is the case. You know, we've got tonight, who needs tomorrow, you know?
I've never heard that story before. You're the only person I've never heard that story from Bob or anyone else.
Well, what can I say? When I was listening back to those clips, I'm like, wow, I don't remember hearing him say that ever again, or I forgot that he had mentioned that, or this, or the line about rich people, or when he was talking about night moves, you know.
Right.
Who knows what happens over the years with comments about tunes.
Well, John, because we're in radio, so as soon as you hang up, I'm going to take full credit for that. So, right?
Please do.
I'll tell Don Anthony, it'll be fine. Nobody will know. Shh, quiet. Our little secret. I'll tell it at boot camp and everyone will believe us. For you aren't in radio, you have no idea what the hell we were just talking about, but don't worry about it. But all his storytelling, though, John, that's the thing with Seeger. The songs tell. Main Street was in Ann Arbor. I mean, you know, yeah. That's what he wrote about. I mean, the high school memories of Pioneer. I mean, you know, cruising. Yeah. We get listeners to send us pictures of Bob leaning against someone sent us a picture of Bob. He must have been right out of high school. They had a keg and they were leaning against a car. Bob was trying to pump it to get any more beer out of it.
Well, you know, there was activity in the rural fields around Ann Arbor by certain teen elements during that time at night where all sorts of bizarre activities would take place in the summer. And, come on, it's so cool to be from a town the size of, like, Ann Arbor and have this major rock star come up through your hometown. I mean, Detroit has obviously millions of people and has a great music heritage, but you know, being from a smaller community, so to speak, that's just like the coolest thing.
Yeah.
I don't know how to tell you. It's just, and it's somebody that you really like. You know what I mean? It's not just. I have an adult daughter who's way into Iggy and the Stooges. Okay, so I'm not into Iggy and the Stooges as much as I am into Bob Seger, but, you know, I sat behind Jim Osterberg while he did drums for the Prime Movers, and that's cool, but not quite as cool to me as Bob Seger, just personally. You know, he's just Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you name it. He's got every credential on the resume that one could possibly ask for.
I still don't understand why no one, and I've been trying to work on this for years, John, is a tribute album to Bob. We always get other artists that, you know, you get a group of artists and they cover some one person's music.
Right.
I asked Joe Elliott from Def Leppard, and he and Phil Collins both said they would love to do Hollywood Nights. That's like their favorite. They immediately blurted it out. We've talked to a lot of musicians that are interested in doing that. I think it would work if you could get enough people to do it. And even like Detroit centric, if you got Wally Palmer from the Romantics and I mean, you know, wouldn't it be cool to get him to do that? Yeah.
Oh yeah. God, that would be awesome. Maybe it'll happen someday. I don't know. I don't know why not. You know, obviously rock ready. Yeah. Obviously rock and roll never forgets. So
hold on, hold on, hold on. Let me get the bell. There it is. That's three. Okay.
I mean, what a great line is that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So who knows?
Sweet 16 turned 31. And he wrote that about going back to his high school reunion here in Ann Arbor. He was anxious about going back to it.
Yeah. But, you know, every time I go down, I mean, obviously I've been down Main Street in Ann Arbor, I don't know, a zillion times. And to know that that was the genesis behind the tune is just a really cool thing.
Oh, we're so geeky here that we know that I asked him once, like the 12 hours out of Mackinac City and Roll Me Away.
Yeah.
That's a bar in Minnesota. That's a real place. He really did.
I'm sure.
He really did that.
I think you'll find that a common denominator between people who write, whether it's songs, movies, books, whatever, a lot of those stories, lyrics, have references to actual experiences, real places. They may be presented in a, you know, Main Street. Well, there are a lot of Main Streets around America. But the one that, you know, inspires Seeger is the one in Ann Arbor. Yet somebody in Denver or Texas or Kansas or Philadelphia hears Main Street, and that clicks in their mind as to the Main Street that they reference. So it's a common denominator based on a specific place and a specific instance.
Night moves for anyone who ever went to a drive-in movie theater. I mean, come on. That's what you did. That's what you did.
That is what you did.
Yeah.
Been there, done that. Got the speaker on the post.
And what you did was you picked the worst movie possible so they would have no interest in the film at all, right? You would, like, take a girl to go see Midnight Express because you knew she wasn't going to be interested in the movie about a Turkish prison. And then you're like, cool, okay, I might have a chance here.
Yeah, except if you steamed up the car's windows too much, they had usually had a guy, or I don't know if it was a real security guard or a policeman walking around with a flashlight. Hey, you kids, knock that off!
John, I had a 74 Vega hatchback. The only way I was getting action in high school is if she punched me. That was it. Yeah. My friend had a great line. He looked at me and goes, the only way you're getting laid is if you stick your head up a chicken's ass. I'm like, all right, you win. That's my favorite line. It's stuck for all those years, man.
Awesome.
John Records Landecker, man. It's so much fun talking to you. Obviously, your career in radio, and we're all fans, but more importantly, you're a fan of Seeger. And you speak about it genuinely. And as a Detroiter and so many people in the Motor City, we love you for that, man. We love you for that.
Oh, well, thank you. It's my upbringing. What can I say? It's who I am. It's where I came from. And, you know, it's always going to be a part of what I do.
I guess you could say it's that old time rock and roll. There you go.
Let me put on my underwear and slide across the linoleum.
Now, save that for Morning Show Boot Camp. We got to have something to talk about in Chicago.
Okay.
So
I'll remember that.
John Records Landecker, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, bud.
My pleasure. Had a great time.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.